Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Monday, November 28th, 2022. And today on this episode, I'm talking about the central bank, the engine that drives the most powerful and probably the most dangerous government in history. I'm going to go back in time a bit, and instead of just focusing on the Federal Reserve, of course, we need to end the Fed if we want to have liberty, but I want to talk about the root core, the foundation, the precursor to what we have today, and that is Alexander Hamilton's First National Bank of 1791, which didn't last. It didn't last, but it did set the stage for much of what we labor under today, not just the Federal Reserve, but the entire monster state. I'm going to share with you an overview of the constitutional arguments, three big problems we got from it. I'm going to be citing people like Edmund Randolph, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. And at the end of the episode, I've got a really great book that I'm going to recommend for you, a handbook, a short one from here at the TAC that I think you will definitely enjoy. But first of all, before getting to that, hello and thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Whether this is your first episode or you've been here for every single one since day one, I can't thank you enough. While we allow people another minute or so to get notifications to join us on the mainstream live stream platforms, I want to say hi to everyone out in the live chat. I hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving weekend. I hope you had a great time with friends, family, loved ones, whatever you may have been doing, and your week is off to a good start as well. Hi to Tim Martin in Arizona, Haji in Southeast Michigan, Cheriton Farmer in Missouri, Dixie Strong in Bama, Liberty Revolution, good to see you, buddy. Melody Skaman, Clay Kent, Joseph Collin Experiment in Kentucky, Kirk Morrison in South Carolina, Jonathan in North Dakota, Raymond Rowe, Brian in Georgia, Crystal Thomas, Shannon in Texas, good to see you, Shannon. Melissa Harrell as well, Senator DT in Elkhart, Indiana, Raymond Rowe, Lauren Smith, post-Thanksgiving welcome for West Virginia. Appreciate that. Alan Hughes in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and everyone else. I know I missed a bunch, and others usually get in a little bit later. A lot of times these mainstream platforms aren't as awesome as we'd like them to be, but of course they're a tool for us to be able to spread and amplify a message in support of the Constitution and liberty, whether the establishment, the government wants us to or not. And I should mention, I'm going to cite a bunch of stuff in this episode. I've got a few other episodes. I've got a bunch of articles and original source documents. You're going to find those over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. I publish a blog post for each individual episode about 1 to 2 hours after the live stream is done. And there you're going to find a show link section where I'm including all the stuff that I'm mentioning so you can read and learn more in context on your own time. Let's start out with an article by Mike Meharry. This is a great way to sum it up. The Federal Reserve is the engine that drives the biggest, most powerful government in the history of the world. That's not a government of few and defined powers, as James Madison described it. Unfortunately, the people for generations and generations have let it get out of control and in many cases begged for it. But the Federal Reserve is the tool that they use to be able to actually prop this whole system up. Mike goes on, he says, we can trace the origins of this modern central bank back to the creation of the first Bank of the United States, even before ratification of the Bill of Rights. I've done a couple of episodes trying to answer the question of when things went off the rails. When did we go from a limited constitutional republic to the monster state we have of today? And to the founders and the old revolutionaries, it was really about precedent. And when you establish a precedent for them to take, as Thomas Jefferson said in his argument against Hamilton's bank, which I will get to a little bit later on the show, if you take a single step beyond the limits of the Constitution, you take a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. We'll see if I get that quote right off the top of my head. And so I've often cited 1791, the creation of the first bank, as the moment things went off the rails. Anyways, Mike goes on. He says, even then, it was built on dubious constitutional justifications. He's being kind. But it wasn't created without a fight. The arguments advanced by the bank's opponents provide a great deal of insight into the original understanding of the Constitution and the American system as it was conceived. The original Constitution, which only really lasted because of the bank, for just a couple of years. And Mike points out that the story is about more than central banking. And I know we're talking about the Federal Reserve, but the powers that they use to create this and what they use to fund because of it goes way beyond just the creation of a bank. He said it's really a battle for the heart and soul of America's constitutional system. He says if you understand the constitutional arguments against the first bank of the U.S., and here we're going to hear from Edmund Randolph, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, three very influential figures at the time of the founding. He said you will have a solid grasp on the constitutional arguments against much of the unconstitutional monster state we live under today. Now, we know, and as I just mentioned right at the beginning, for those of you looking at the screen, this is my favorite Alexander Hamilton picture. It's him gagged. I was going to show a picture of the Aaron Burr thing, but, well, that's for maybe another episode. But the bank was the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton. Surprise, surprise. It was vehemently opposed by those three Virginians. But Hamilton wanted this as a tool to do all kinds of stuff. He was a supporter of a big, big government. Something that would, well, no one really supported what he really wanted to go for, and that's why he had to flip-flop. He proposed one thing, or he said one thing before ratification, and then right after ratification, especially leading up to the creation of the bank, suddenly he started finding things like implied powers. So he couldn't justify the bank on the delegated powers in the Constitution. There was no debate over that. People were very clear, and you'd see this over and over in the debates, like, okay, we can't find it expressly delegated, so, well, how do you find this power? Now, people who are honest and doing the right thing, they're not going to try to first start out with what they want to get done and then figure out how to shoehorn it in the Constitution. It's supposed to be the other way around. But Hamilton, of course, wanted to shoehorn it in. He primarily made the case that suddenly after ratification, the word necessary no longer meant necessary. Suddenly the word necessary meant just merely convenient. So instead of having to prove that a national bank was, quote, necessary and proper, as noted in Article 1, Section 8, for carrying out another delegated power, both necessary and proper, it would just make things more convenient to do stuff. So, and there's, I mean, it's not hard for a creative mind to come up with things that government could do that could make it more convenient for them to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all these different things that have been delegated to it. Now, I covered this whole idea of necessary and proper in a recent episode. I don't know if I have it here. Necessary is supposed to mean necessary just in September of this year. I will link to that in the show notes. Now, Hamilton also argued in favor of implied powers. Now, we know that implication, that was a real problem. Patrick Henry was very much concerned about implied powers, implied authority. In his final ratification debate speeches in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, he warned about this. Hey, if you're not careful about really nailing this thing down, they're going to claim all kinds of implied authority. He warned against that in 1788. And here, just a few years later, they went with it. We've got an article. I should have had this in my show notes, but T.J. Martinell wrote a great article about Patrick Henry's last speeches and talking about implied authority. We just published it maybe an hour or two ago over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Anyways, here's to Hamilton himself. For example, here's one of his arguments in support of the bank. This is February 23rd, 1791. He said, "It is not denied that there are implied," and he highlights the word implied, "there are implied as well as express powers, and that the former are as effectually delegated as the latter." So Hamilton here is definitely saying, you have this idea of delegated powers that are few and defined. That's how Madison described it. He was a co-author with Hamilton of the Federalist Papers, and they made the case that the powers delegated to the federal government would be few and defined, very clearly spelled out, not just something that was made out of implication. And here's Hamilton just a couple years later saying, well, there's definitely implied powers and they have the same authority as anything that's spelled out in the document in and of itself. And in fact, if you command or control F through the document, which I will link to in the show notes, you can find the word implied 10, 12 times. He just really keeps hammering this home over and over and over. So the big things that Hamilton is basically saying, he acknowledges that there is no express delegation to incorporate anything, much less a bank. So he's saying, well, there's now implied powers. It's implied that the central government needs this authority to be able to, I don't know, regulate commerce or create post offices, et cetera, et cetera. And then, well, necessary doesn't mean necessary. It means, well, this will help make things more convenient because of its implication for the power of the federal government. Anyways, it's pretty bad stuff. But on the opposing side, we have Edmund Randolph, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. And here, Edmund Randolph, one of his opinions, this is February 12th, 1791. He said, the power of creating corporations is not expressly given to Congress. That's obvious. He says that the power of creating corporations is not expressly given to Congress is obvious. It's very clear. Everyone understood that creating a bank, incorporating a bank, was not in the document. You can read it yourself. It's not there. Everyone knew that. So he's saying, well, let's look at the arguments that are going to be made in favor of this. So if it can be a power that's exercised, Randolph said, it must be first because the nature of the federal government implies it. So he's laying out the arguments of the Hamiltonians, and then he goes through each one of them and rejects all of them pretty straightforward. One, because the nature of the federal government implies it. Two, because it is involved in some of the specified powers of legislation, or three, because it is necessary and proper to carry into execution some of the specified powers. I'm not going to go into this, any of these, in any real detail, but I want to just give you some highlights. And of course, as I keep mentioning, I will link to these original documents in the show notes, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty, so you can read it in full detail if you want to get Randolph's arguments against the National Bank and against the doctrine of implication and his support of the original legal meaning of necessary and proper and the like. And responding to the implied power, he's rejecting the Hamiltonian view. He said to be implied in the nature of the federal government would beget a doctrine so indefinite as to grasp every power. In other words, to claim that they can charter or they can incorporate a bank because it's implied in the nature of the federal government. Just that's all they need to do. The government is not one of limited delegated powers. It's the British system where they can just do basically whatever they want. Now, that was really, in essence, that's arbitrary government. A government can determine the extent of its own power, what it can do by implication of its authority. That's something that they would have called arbitrary government during the Revolution. And that was listed as one of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence. So here it is, just not that long out of the gate. And they're basically, there are people there who are doing what they fought a long bloody war to get away from. Maybe Hamilton never really wanted to get away from it in the first place. So to be implied that they can create this bank would basically give them unlimited power, a doctrine so indefinite as to grasp every power. Now, he does take a little bit more of a middle ground on some things, but he talks a little bit about the necessary and proper clause here in this way. He says to be necessary is to be incidental. Now, necessary and proper, we know that Hamilton is saying it means convenient, but really the original legal meaning of this is something called the legal doctrine of principles and incidents. Incidental power is not the same as implied power. An incidental power, they have the power to establish post offices, but it's an incidental power, something that's necessary to establish a post office. You have to have employees to be in that post office. So that's one very simplistic example of this type of thing. It can't be greater. It has to be, like, without that power, you can't actually do it. Without the incidental power, you can't do the delegated power. That's the whole point of the word necessary. So Randolph says to be necessary is to be incidental. Or in other words, may be demonstrated, denominated by the natural, wow, I'm struggling with reading today. To be necessary is to be incidental, or in other words, may be denominated the natural means of executing a power. And he goes on, the phrase and proper, if it has any meaning, does not enlarge the powers of Congress, but rather restricts them. Of course, people treat the necessary and proper clause as the whatever the hell they want clause today. That includes politicians, that includes advocacy groups, that includes average people. Oh, I think such and such should be done. This is necessary and proper to achieve the things that I like. So, but this is a warning. Still, again, Randolph with another warning. He actually, if you read through this in comparison, especially to Jefferson and also a bit to Madison, Randolph is a little bit more middle ground between them and the Hamiltonian view, but it's still pretty hardcore in comparison to anybody today. No one takes this type of view today. However, he writes, let it be propounded as an eternal question to those who would build new powers on this clause, whether the latitude of construction which they arrogate will not terminate in an unlimited power in Congress. Again, here he is warning not just on the idea of implied powers, but on necessary being something other than the principles of incidental powers rather than implied powers or convenient powers. He's saying this is going to terminate, most likely, in an unlimited power in Congress. And if we are not there today, we're certainly pretty damn close. I actually covered, I'm not going to talk too much more about necessary and proper. If you really want to dig in deep and learn more about the doctrine of principles and incidents and the precursor to the necessary and proper, etc., I did a pretty long episode on this, somewhere around 35 minutes or so back in 2019. Necessary and proper, not anything and everything. Of course, that will be linked to in the show notes, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path-to-liberty. Someone tells me that audio is skipping. Hopefully you guys are having okay, or maybe that was just an issue on one of the platforms. If anything, I do record this locally, so I do upload that to the platforms a little bit later, at least the archive platforms where we put the video like on Gab and Minds and Brighteon. And of course, we have the audio-only podcast edition on Apple and Spotify, iHeart, TuneIn, et cetera, et cetera. I should also mention that the only way that we're able to do this kind of work is through the financial faith and support of our members. I know this is a quick advertisement here, but without the support of our members, we don't have the time or the resources to be able to get this kind of information together. We've got over 10,000 articles on our website. I've been doing this podcast for over 4 years now. We're doing our best to reach and teach people about the Constitution and liberty and how to defend both, whether the government wants us to or not. And I want to take a quick moment to say thank you to a handful of people who have joined us as members recently. There's Dan in Idaho, Scott in Missouri, Ronald in California, Cynthia in California, Richard in Texas, Carol in Oklahoma, Lewis in Florida, Henry in North Carolina, and a bunch of other people. I really, really appreciate your support. Thank you so much. If you want to join them, it's 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. Anyways, let me jump over to James Madison here. He's next. And I did another episode. We're going to be citing a lot of episodes in this episode. In 1791, here's from the overview of it. James Madison gave two major speeches on the National Bank, opposing it primarily on grounds that it wasn't a power expressly delegated in the Constitution. He also, which is the 10th Amendment argument, that's the argument that Jefferson made as well. Madison also rejected claims that use the general welfare and necessary and proper clauses, along with the power to borrow money and the preamble. Here, for example, from his speech of February 2nd, again, he's talking about necessary and proper and the doctrine of principles and incidents. He says, whatever meaning this clause may have, none can be admitted that would give an unlimited discretion to Congress. Again, warning about unlimited discretion, unlimited power was what Randolph did. And here, James Madison, the so-called father of the Constitution, is saying the same thing. He said, its meaning must, according to the natural and obvious force of the terms and the context, be limited to means necessary to the end and incident to the nature of the specified powers. Again, necessary means necessary. Without it, it can't exist. Not just whatever the hell you want, not just convenient. That's how they were twisting it. And so Madison was very, very forceful, very straightforward on that. Now, for more details, you definitely want to check out that episode that I just mentioned on Madison. And here again, if proceeded he, Congress, by virtue of the power to borrow, and this is Madison's warning now again, unlimited power, can create the means of lending, and in pursuance of these means can incorporate a bank, they may do anything, whatever, creative, of like means. So Madison, just like Edmund Randolph warning about unlimited power, he warns they may do anything, whatever, creative. And they do anything, whatever, creative, of like means on almost every single issue today. So make sure again to check out that episode on Madison. I will link to it in the show notes. Here's one more from Thomas Jefferson. He opposed it primarily on 10th Amendment grounds. I've got another episode that I will link. He also rejected claims that use the commerce, general welfare, and necessary and proper clauses. And this is why Mike Meharry in that article was talking about how, well, if you understand the arguments against the National Bank, you're going to learn a lot about the original legal meaning of the Constitution, because, of course, people who support the monster state, when they get rejected on saying, well, this is regulating interstate commerce, well, if they lose that argument, they'll say, well, then it's general welfare. If they lose that argument, oh, well, it's necessary and proper. Oh, they lose that. They just keep going. And oh, it's implied powers. So you will understand that debate, because that's exactly what they were doing in 1791. Now, Jefferson's argument, which I'm going to link here as well, it literally starts. He first lays out, this is what the bill that we're discussing does. That he makes 8 points, and then he starts his argument against it, and he starts with the 10th Amendment. He says, I consider the foundation of the Constitution is laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by the states are reserved to the states or to the people. The final version was a little different. This was 10 months before it was ratified, but that's how Jefferson said, like, look, soon as you can't go beyond these limits. He said to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. This, like Randolph and Madison, is a warning that authorizing a bank, something that's not delegated to the federal government in the Constitution, will lead to unlimited power. That's why it's so important to understand these original arguments, because they're really talking about precedent. And as soon as you give them that single step to tyranny, they're going to take whatever, however many thousands of steps over time to get to despotism. And they get to that pretty quickly today. So Madison himself actually made the case in his debates, and I covered that in the episode, that during the Philadelphia Convention, there was actually a proposal to authorize incorporating corporations, maybe specifically even a bank, for example. And Madison said, well, we considered it and rejected it. We didn't want the federal government to have this power. And that was additional reinforcement to say, well, no, they thought about it and they said, no, we're not going to include this. So therefore, the people of the several states were not actually even debating about that particular power. Madison would know, and he didn't claim it at the time, but it was his proposal. So it's actually an interesting level of integrity for him to be able to do something like that. Anyway, so here's again Jefferson talking about necessary and proper. He said, the Constitution allows only the means which are necessary. Necessary means necessary. It doesn't mean something else. The Constitution allows only the means which are necessary, not those which are merely convenient for affecting the enumerated powers. If such a latitude of construction be allowed to this phrase as to give any non-enumerated power, it will go to everyone. For there is not one which ingenuity may not torture into a convenience, in some instance or other, to someone of so long a list of enumerated powers. It would swallow up all the delegated powers and reduce the whole to one power. So if you can just say necessary means convenient, you don't need the rest of the document because, well, it's just necessary and proper. It's convenient to whatever the heck they want. And Jefferson really, really hammered that home. Now, of course, if you want more detail on Jefferson's views, there's the link to that episode, Thomas Jefferson, the Constitution versus the National Bank. I did that episode October of 2020. Now, although the National Bank, George Washington signed this thing into law, and I still, like, I know Brian McClanahan told me about this, and I don't think he was surprised that it happened, but for some reason, you know, I think about people like Jefferson, Randolph, Madison, very, very powerful, very, very influential Virginians, of which George Washington was one as well. They're all telling him, don't do this. Washington actually had two veto messages ready to roll, but decided to go with it. I have a hard time grasping it, but I guess he was on the Hamiltonian big government side, and I got to just get through that and realize that because of this, he helped bring down the Republic in a way. You know, that's a real problem there. But he did sign it. It did not last forever. And even though it wasn't permanent, we still got three big things. Of course, the one I keep mentioning over and over and over, precedent. Randolph, of course, warned of unlimited power in Congress. Madison warned that Congress may do anything, whatever, creative. Jefferson said a boundless field of power that they would have. Precedent is what established more and more and more in the years to come until, well, instead of having a constitutional republic, principles of the revolution where liberty was the primary object, as Patrick Henry once described it, we have absolute federal supremacy almost in all situations. And then, of course, number two, we had the expansive view of the Necessary and Proper Clause. And years later in the McCulloch versus Maryland case, Chief Justice John Marshall adopted the Hamiltonian view that necessary means convenient. And Randy Barnett, in his research, points out that, well, in law school, no one even learns about the opposing views of Madison, Jefferson, and Randolph or anyone else. They only learn the Hamiltonian view. They only learn the John Marshall view, repeating Hamilton in some places word for word. And that's it. It's as if there's no debate over it. And we shouldn't be surprised then that all the so-called experts think that necessary means convenient. And then, of course, this all leads to an even more powerful and destructive central bank, which is the third thing that we have today. There's probably many other things that we could say are an outgrowth of this, but these are the big ones. Now, Mike Meharry went to a lot more detail on this in a book that I mentioned I was going to point out to you, The National Bank versus the Constitution. We've had this available as a free ebook for our members since he finished it last summer. But we finally made it available in print version, and I know a number of people purchased copies of that over the Thanksgiving holiday. So I've got a link to it, The National Bank versus the Constitution. It's just a little handbook, but it's got really good info on those constitutional arguments. How many chapters is this thing? It is 11 short chapters. They're generally like 6 pages each, like talking about the Federal Reserve, Hamilton's arguments, the power to charter, Madison views, the Commerce Clause arguments, general welfare, the necessary and proper arguments. It's $15. We will mail you a copy pretty quickly. And I will link to that in the show notes. The alternative version is you can get it for $2 if you're okay getting an ebook. Members, all of our members get all of our ebook, all of our book publications for free on members.10thamendmentcenter.com, our members website. And not only if it starts out at $2 a month, not only do you get this book, you get like 10 of them. So technically, if you wanted to game the system and scam us, it's kind of a scammy approach. You could sign up for the $2, download all the books, and then just cancel it. And basically, you get everything for $2. I mean, I really believe that you are going to really see the value of the work that we're doing here and want to help us do more. So every couple of bucks of that dirty, nasty government fiat that they keep devaluing, we use to throw back in the face of the empire to reach and teach people about the original legal meaning of the Constitution and liberty, how to defend both when government refuses to do so, which is constantly. And it ultimately, as John Dickinson put it, it is up to the supreme sovereignty or final authority of the people to protect and preserve their own constitution and their own liberty. Again, 10thamendmentcenter.com/members is where you get that, the ebook, the PDF downloads, $2 a month for all of them, or we'll mail you one for 15. Anyways, I hope you guys found this interesting. I hope it was educational. There are some free ways to support our work as well. You don't have to throw money at us. If I know it's tight for a lot of people these days, don't feel any pressure to do that. And I see someone over in the chat. I'm going to look through some of the comments here in just a moment, mentioning The Creature from Jekyll Island is a great book from G. Edward Griffin, who I got the chance to meet at his home once in person a few years ago. Really, really kind, brilliant person. But there are some free ways to support us. Liking the show, whatever platform you're on, reviews on Apple Podcasts, sharing links to comments, all of these things will trigger algorithms of these mainstream platforms and tell us to show the program to more people. Let me take a look over in the chat and see if there's any comments or questions. I can get this off the screen here. I should figure out how to way to scroll some of these comments up here. Liberty Revolutionary, awesome. Precedent goes right back to John Dickinson's remarks back in 1764, actually 1765, in his pamphlet against the Stamp Act. He says, don't comply with the Stamp Act. This is how you beat the Stamp Act, is by refusing to comply. Because if you do, if you use that, if you use the stamped papers, you establish what he called the detestable precedent for those who wish to varnish the new forged authority, rivet perpetual chains around your unhappy country. This is the language that he used. As soon as you give them the precedent on one thing, they have no reason to repeal on their own. So a refusal to comply to Dickinson was so essential. It was Raymond who mentioned Creature from Jekyll Island. Haji 1954 says Bolden, Meharry, and TJ Martinell and the entire TAC team do great work. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate. Dan says, give how to join again. It's 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. I'm very grateful for any consideration you can give. It takes a little while to get that activated, but once you submit your membership, you should have access to all the ebooks to download within usually a half a day, sometimes just an hour or so. Kirk asks, how can I actually help as a volunteer? That's a tough one, but email us over at team@10thamendmentcenter.com. I'm not actually sure. We don't have someone who actually coordinates. We're so grassroots that we do need support. So I really appreciate that offer to help out. Send us an email and either Mike or I or someone will get back to you in the coming days. Really, really appreciate that. Let's take a look and see if there's any other questions. Melody says, if all laws included a sunset clause, each and every law would have to be renewed periodically, thus incorporating or excluding case law, perhaps. Well, the Patriot Act had all kinds of sunsets, and I'm not sure if just relying on Congress to end the power that Congress should not be exercising in the first place is really a great strategy. I don't think there's really too many examples of that working very well. We have an ongoing growth of government, and as long as people continue to treat acts of the government as constitutional until the government says that they made a mistake and shouldn't have been doing in the first place, I don't think this is ever going to stop. Ultimately, and I've got a bunch of other episodes on this, ultimately, as long as the people continue to comply with unconstitutional acts, we're going to get more and more of the same. NorCal says the bankers are the root of all corruption. Well, maybe. They're pretty bad. Leslie says, always appreciate what you share, Bolden. I appreciate that feedback. And I will probably look a little bit more. I know Eleanor said audio was skipping. Hopefully that was just on her end there and everything worked well in the stream. I didn't see any other comments on that. Anyways, I will take a look at that in just a little bit here once I wrap up. I appreciate you spending some time with me today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you learned something, and I'll see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.